Here we are tonight with our second class of the Hasidic world of Elie Wiesel. And last week, we really talked a bunch about the origins and the timing of the Hasidic world itself, what it meant, and how that time fits together with Wiesel's time, especially the Shoah. We talked a little bit about what is the nature of Hasidic stories, what makes them what they are, and we looked at and analyzed a couple of interesting and somewhat unusual Hasidic stories. So our topic, our target for this week is no less aggressive. So tonight, what I'd like to do with you together is a number of different things. The whole idea of the Hasidic world assumes, because we referred to it briefly last week, that Hasidic Judaism has a unique and different connection to the Kabbalah, or Jewish mysticism. And mysticism has always been a part of Jewish life, but the Hasidic universe and Hasidic Judaism really has a bigger place for Kabbalah, for Jewish mysticism, than does any other Jewish worldview or way of being Jewish. So tonight, because I'm not smart enough to avoid it, I'd like to try to explain in a basic way what makes a Kabbalistic approach to Judaism and to the world different from a non-Kabbalistic approach. When people talk about Kabbalah, about Jewish mysticism, I touched on it very, very, very generally last week. I can try to be a little more specific this week because I think that's important to understanding what is it that's happening in these stories. I want to do that today, and just for fun, we'll draw distinctions between Kabbalah, Orthodox Judaism, what I call historical Judaism, and Reform Judaism. So just for fun, because we have hours and hours, oh no, we have about an hour and a half, we're going to try to get a general picture of those. Going to share a couple more Hasidic stories like we did last week, that hopefully we can use some of these tools to understand what makes these stories on the one hand so unusual and on the other hand so compelling. And I want to start in a moment with one of the stories from Wiesel's book. And I want to conclude tonight with the way in which Wiesel's approach to Hasidic stories is by autobiographical. Right? That he doesn't just tell the stories. In a way, whenever he's telling stories, and much of his nonfiction writing is in fact the telling of stories, what he's often doing, in my opinion, having read a lot of his work, and what he's doing in particular when he's telling Hasidic stories that touch on his own personal background, is he's really telling us about him. But he does that in one place, particularly overtly, in the book that is kind of the source book of this course. Even though we're not just sitting here and going through the book, because I thought individuals can mostly do that by themselves. That book is called Somewhere a Master, Hasidic, that's the angle with the lights, Hasidic Portraits and Legends, Somewhere a Master, Hasidic Portraits and Legends by Elie Wiesel. And in there, he tells the following story, which is one of my favorite stories in general, and my favorite Hasidic stories that I've ever learned. It's such an important story that when I've retold it, I have accidentally retold it about four different Hasidic masters, even though it's really only about one of them. So it's that good a story. The story in this book, he tells this story, and I believe in every book where he tells it, I've one of the book of his where he tells the same story, is about the holy José of Lublin, the seer, S-E-E-R, of Lublin, who was a phenomenal and influential Hasidic Rebbe, one of the earlier generations of the Hasidic universe, and who we'll talk a little more about him next week, because we're going to focus this week on stories that are more around youth and birth. And we're going to focus next week with stories that are more about aging and death, since we're trying to sort of, in a very brief time, cover as much of the waterfront as possible. But he tells the following story about the early life of the Chosze of Lublin, of the Seer of Lublin. It seems that the Seer of Lublin, before that was his name, when he was only a little boy, when he was 3-4 years old, he went to cheder, like any other little Jewish boy. And, like any other little Jewish boy, he didn't appear to like cheder. Because he was learning cheder in this little room in the village, and instead of staying in the room to learn in cheder from the Rebbe, he got up and walked right out of the cheder into the woods. Well, the Rebbe was unimpressed. We used to go down to the beach when I left cheder. That's not in the story. But he instead went off into the woods. The Melamed, the teacher, the Rebbe, was not impressed. And so he got in touch with his father. And he said, "Your son, he didn't even stay in class. He didn't stay in cheder. He left and he walked off into the woods." So his father, of course, went off and searched for him. This was in the early days of his cheder. And what is the first lesson, the first prayer that Jewish boys, and in our life Jewish girls, learn? What is it? That's right, the Shema. The first thing we learn is the Shema, to say it and to know what it means. And so the father, he's searching for his son in the woods, looking for him, having left cheder. And on the wind, he thinks he can hear a voice. So he follows the voice. And he gets closer to the voice. He's still wandering in the woods. And he can hear it saying just one line over and over again. But he can't really tell what the line is. And he gets closer and he sees that he's coming close to a clearing. And he can hear the words a little more clearly. And he can just hear his son saying, "Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad." And as he comes into the clearing, he gets closer and closer to the boy. And as he gets closer, he can see he's yelling the Shema at the top of his lungs. And so he doesn't even hear his father coming. So his father touches him on the shoulder, and he starts as if he's awakened from a dream. And his father says, "What are you doing?" He says, well, "I'm learning the Shema." His father says, "Well, they were learning the Shema in cheder. Why didn't you stay here? Why didn't you stay there?" And he says, "Well, I needed to do it here." And he says, "Well, the Shema, it teaches us that God is one." "Yes," says the boy, "I know that." He says, "And the Shema teaches us that God is everywhere, and everywhere the same." And the little boy says, "Yeah, God is everywhere, and everywhere the same, but I'm not." He knew that God is the same everywhere, but that we're not. Everywhere we go, everything we see, everything we do, we have a different experience of our world, even if God is the unifying thread that binds all together. This is a story that he tells in a number of different books, in a number of different details. And I've added a number of details that I'm quite certain were in the original story. He just didn't bother to put them in. Because there's no before and after in Hasidic stories, just like the Torah. So tell me about that story. It's one of my favorites. What is the message of that story other than that God is everywhere and everywhere the same and that we're not? What else do you hear about that story that you might be puzzled by or interested in or that might strike you as a meaningful detail?
You don't have to be in cheder to spend time with God.
Okay, so you don't have to be in cheder. I'm going to say, and I'll go ahead, I'm a rabbi, but I'll be heretical, or in shul, right, to have an experience of God. There is a Hasidic practice called hitbodedut, which literally means isolation. It's where you go off away from other people, away from other places, because sometimes the sound of life gets in the way of us hearing what we need to hear. So yeah, that's part of the message there. What else do you hear there? Yeah. Okay, so it talks about, remember, it's a story about learning. So it talks about different kinds of learning. And Gilda's suggesting that maybe one of the messages of the story, which we talked about a little bit last week, is that maybe experiential learning is of at least as high or even a higher nature than formal learning. Absolutely. What else do we find in this? Yes, Story.
I find that here he went into nature, mm-hmm. beautiful nature. So he was surrounded by the forest and the trees and the whole thing. And it gave him that freedom to experience it all and the energy around. Mm-hmm. And then when he was kind of taken out of that, when his father came upon him, because he was so attuned, mm-hmm. so connected, that it's just so special. And I guess he somehow knew intuitively mm-hmm. that that's where he needed to be rather than confined.
Okay. Yeah, Dory said a number of different things. And again, we can each have lots of different insights. But part of the idea here as well, certainly, is that we would expect if this was a more narrow traditional story that he would wander out of the cheder and into the Bez Midrash. And he would walk into the study hall because that's where we find learning. Right? But he found a connection to God, a connection to what is larger, a connection to Torah in himself and in the woods, instead of in more conventional places. Bev, and yes.
I think he was shy, and he didn't like to do it around other people, and he wanted to do it on his own.
Okay, that's quite possible. Now, this is a story about a famous Rebbe when he was very young. So a reminder as well about the nature of Hasidic stories. It's a true story, it just may never have happened. Okay, and that sounds funny, but I'm being entirely serious, right? Because the notion of historical truth and spiritual truth are not in conflict with one another, but they are most certainly in the Hasidic world and in our world not the same thing. So just like when people become famous, the events of their life become greater later on. This story is true and real, whether it ever really happened or not. And the other thing that I will draw forth from that story, and then I'll take a couple quick comments and move on, because as I said, we're trying to do like 6 months of a class tonight in one night. What is it? I think there's also an issue here. Who is the teacher? Right? Who is the teacher? Who is the master? Because it's very clear this story involves a Malamed or a Rebbe, right? A hired teacher, a father who himself happens also to have been well known for his learning and his leadership, and a little boy, right? And who's the teacher? The little boy. Right? So it's again a reminder, which is a very common trait in Hasidic thinking. And I think we said last time that there's a lot of Hasidic thinking, even among non-Hasidic people in the world today, that teachers aren't necessarily who they seem to be. And wisdom doesn't necessarily come from books and from experience. This is not to push off those things and say they have no value. No Jewish perspective rejects the value of learning and experience. But it says there's a higher truth, there's a higher source, and there is a part of us that is not about those things. There is a spiritual level, a neshama, a soul within each of us that is, as we saw that image in a story last week, a divine spark. And you know, every spark is different. Every soul is different. right? I mean, forget Hasidism. How many times have you heard somebody refer to a young person in a positive way as an old soul? Right? And when we say that, what are we really saying? We're really saying this same message. Right? We're saying that if you open your mind and your heart and your ears, there are more teachers out there than you think, and most of them aren't standing at the front of a class with a microphone. And so it's a reminder, and again, and the Hasidic world is a less high, it's at once very hierarchical and very democratic, right? Because there are these great tzaddikim, these great people, these great souls, and yet the idea that everyone has a soul, everyone has spiritual greatness to some degree within them. So there's a tension in these stories between those two things. So when we're talking about entering the realm of the spiritual, what is it we want to talk about? I want to talk a little bit about the place of Kabbalah in Jewish life, about a brief take, because that's all we have time for, but less brief than last week, just one sentence, on what is Kabbalah. And then I want to assign you a whole other book to read. No. I want to give you an opportunity to read a book that I think is terrific. But I want to hand out to you something I've created to differentiate different Jewish worldviews based on the system from that book. Okay. So Judaism is, it's what binds all Jews together. It is a way of being and belonging and behaving and believing. Pretty much anything that starts with B. But not really anything. It's really about being, belonging, behaving, and believing. It's made up of all those things. Judaism is a religion that takes place in history. Right? If you think about our holidays, all of our holidays are connected to events, whether they happened or not, in the history of the Jewish people, right? Our story of the Jewish people, that's what it's connected to. And it's about a world that had a beginning and is moving toward the ending. But I'm going to suggest to you that mystically based Judaism, and for the moment we'll call it non-mystically based Judaism, have different beginnings and endings. Thank you. I'll bless you later. Thank you all for blessing me. Now, when we talk about non-mystical Judaism, so you all have some experience of this, you're talking about Judaism, the Jewish story, the Jewish beginning, and the Jewish goal or ending. So when you talk about the beginning and the ending of the Jewish story, there's no exact right or wrong, but we'll all end up in the same realm here. What do you think of? What's the beginning? What's the ending? Okay, so maybe the beginning is creation. That's one beginning. There's no right. There's a number of answers here. And if creation is the beginning, then what's the ending? Okay, Sinai is kind of early in the Torah to be an ending. But it is sort of a next step. There's no question. Sure. Okay, we are living it, but whether we get there or not, we have a goal. We're trying to get somewhere. So one of them, Nomi said, is Mashiach. Right? One of them is Mashiach. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about what Mashiach is, because there's lots of things. It's a wonderful book edited by Jacob Neusner called Judaism and Its Messiahs. That's about all these different Jewish ideas of Mashiach. Great book. So we can't summarize the book in one night, but really the idea of a world perfected, right? Now, what was the imperfection at the beginning of the Jewish story? How did our story start? Pardon? Okay, well, now the Garden of Eden is the human story, right? So in the Garden of Eden, which is a Jewish story about all humans, it's not a Jewish story about Jews, right? And so the Jewish story about all human beings has the Garden of Eden, which talks about kind of a perfectly orderly world that we all know doesn't exist. That's kind of the first chapter of Genesis. And then after that, we have the story actually of the Garden of Eden, which kind of explains why the world is the way that it is. It's more about the human condition in the world, I'm going to suggest. Okay? But Judaism starts a couple different times. It starts Lech Lecha last week. It starts with Abraham and Sarah, Avram and Sarai, and off they go. And they're on their journey, and that journey is about a clan, right? The tribe, the clan of Abraham, or as we modern people would say, Abraham and Sarah. But there is a place outside of the Holy Land where we go from being a clan to a people. And where is that? It's Mitzrayim. It's Egypt. Right? And so in Egypt, it's there, in fact, that the Pharaoh, who knew not Joseph, calls us a people for the first time. And we become a people through the experience of being slaves. And from slavery, we go free, going to Sinai, hoping to serve God. And there we're given a blueprint to do so. Right? We're given the Torah. And the Torah and the tradition are our blueprint that just like one time we were redeemed by God from Egypt, the goal is for the Jewish people to bring redemption, Mashiach, Mashiach Zeit, whatever you want to call it, to the whole world. Right? There are many different ideas. That's one of them. Because frankly, hard for us to have redemption if we're the only ones, right? Doesn't really work. So even if the goal is to redeem the Jews, you can't do it if you don't redeem the world. Because otherwise you can't live that kind of a just, righteous, peaceful life. Okay? And how do we get from redemption number one, from Egypt, to redemption number two, the redemption of the world? We do so through the covenant, through the Torah, through doing mitzvot, and we do so through real world life, through living in history, creating society, following our traditions, creating a place for our people in the beautiful land of Israel that we were given, returning in modern times to that beautiful land. Why? To continue to build a Jewish society, a Jewish vision here in this world. So what are we doing? We are redeeming the world through the actual real life actions that take place in our world, right? Whether we're out there feeding the hungry or we're davening at a minyan immediately before the class. Oh, by the way, a great way to prepare for class is to daven at the minyan immediately before class, 6:30. It's about existing in history and living our life in the real physical world, right? So, we're going right to left. Here's your right. We're going to be Hebrew, so we'll go right to left for you, right? So here's redemption number one. And we're going to interact with other peoples, with each other. We're going to do mitzvot. We're going to do the right thing. We're going to live a good life. And eventually here, with Hashem's help, with God's help, with divine help, we're going to have redemption number two, the good world, and that's how we do it. Okay? That's historical Judaism. Okay? That is not the viewpoint of Kabbalistic Judaism. Okay? Kabbalistic Judaism is not about the evolution of history. You have to take the timeline that I don't have here, and you have to turn it on its end. Because it's not about from earlier to later. It's about the evolution of God's presence in the world. It's about a spiritual reality that is, in fact, deeper and more significant than the physical reality. So we read a story last week with the Baal Shem Tov, who founded Hasidism, exploding, the image of him, into 600,000 sparks, right? Representing all Jews, right? And without getting into the full story of Luriana Kabbalah and all that stuff, take another class from somebody, they'll teach you about that. I will, Kana will, anybody will. Rabbi Englander's great about that. We'll do that. What you're really doing is you are taking God's presence in the world, which is, even though God is one, God's presence in this physical world is disunified. God is hidden in lots of little places, and our job is to unify God's presence, is to take the one God and make God unified, unitary, present, and real in our world. Okay? So it's a different timeline. The timeline of normative Judaism is a historical one. The timeline of mystical, Kabbalistic Judaism is a religious or mystical one. That in the creation of the world, God's presence was hidden everywhere. And our job is to find and collect those sparks, and in doing so, to rebuild the real spiritual world that is here that we can't see. Okay? So in order to do this, before we move on, before I give everybody too much of a headache, because these are big ideas, but they're important ideas, and we'll see them in a concrete way, I want to talk about every modern Jew's favorite term and about the two different things it means. Okay? So somebody tell me what Tikkun Olam means. That's not a trick question. I won't tell you you're wrong. Yes, please.
Repair the world.
Okay, repairing the world. That's correct. Now, I would like three people to give me examples of something you could do that would be Tikkun Olam. Again, not a trick question. You can just shout them out. I don't care. Sally? Feeding the hungry. Fantastic example. Give me another one. Tzedakah, right? You're giving your time, you're giving your money. That's great.
Visiting the bereaved.
Visiting the bereaved. Absolutely. Those are great examples. We could come up with lots more examples. Not going to do it right now. Okay? That is a modern understanding of Tikkun Olam. Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, is originally a mystical concept. And what it originally meant, it's not what it really means, because it really means what we just said too. But the original mystical meaning of Tikkun Olam are mystical, religious, spiritual acts that free divine sparks and make God's presence more felt in the world. Okay, that's what makes the world better. That you can reduce the number of hungry people and suffering in the world more effectively by saying the right Kabbalistic prayer in the right way with the right aspect of the bridge that connects God and the world in mind. That's a more effective way to fix the world than to go out and feed hungry people. Now, if you don't like that idea, it doesn't mean that that's right and you're wrong, or that you're right and that's wrong. It means you're not a Kabbalist, which is okay, because most Jews are not. Okay? But the idea of the Kabbalah, the idea of Jewish mysticism, not as a backdrop to what we do, but as the main story of Jewish life, which it becomes in Hasidism, is that it is in fact these secret personal rituals that we do that free divine sparks and that enable the world to either be a brighter, more godly place or a darker, less godly place if we don't do them or we do them wrong. Okay? And mysticism says that. It says that the key to reality are not the obvious keys. They're the hidden keys. Okay? If you want to think about it, one more image. We think about God's presence flooding into the world. Okay? So at the top, we get top to bottom again. At the top, right? Imagine a fountain. Okay? At the top is a water source. Okay? And for that water to get here down to the bottom, to this world, it's not much of a fountain if it just pours from top to bottom. That's not what a fountain is, right? It looks like what we used to call a pachinko machine, right? There are all kinds of little catch places for the water to land on, and if they're angled just right, almost all the water ends up right in the bottom where it needs to be. But if they're angled wrong, the water ends up pouring off to the side or going somewhere else or not ending up where you need it. Okay? So God is constantly, from a perspective of Jewish mysticism, pouring divine energy, holiness, spirituality, light, whatever you want to talk about it, into the world. Okay? But there is a mechanism. God is too powerful, too holy, too perfect, too much for this physical world. So there is a bridge. There is a fountain through which God's presence has to pass in order to be present in this world. And how do you align those catch basins, if it's light, how do you align the mirrors so that the maximum amount of God's light lands in this world? And the answer is, you study the secret Kabbalistic lore, and by saying prayers and doing rituals with the exact right historical, Kabbalistic, mystical, mostly secret intentions, by doing those things, you make the world a brighter, holier, better place and bring about tikkun olam, bring about the bettering and the eventual redemption of the world. Okay, now, like I said, I don't tell you this idea so you'll love it. Okay, we don't have to love it. But think for a moment. We talked last week about who the early Hasidim were. Okay, right? The early Hasidim were generally rich or poor? Poor. They were generally educated or uneducated comparatively? Uneducated, because they were busy doing luxurious things like trying not to starve to death. Right? It was a very different reality. Okay? Now, what's their ability to go out and start a community food co-op and feed the poor? Right? What's their ability to take a whole bunch of their time and teach children who might not have a chance to learn? What's their ability to take hours a week and dedicate it to their community? They can't do that. They can't do that. So maybe their life doesn't mean anything. Well, that's certainly not true, but you can understand why many people feel that way. They feel like the kind of things they want to do, they can't do. But wait a minute. Maybe you don't need a lot of time or a lot of money or a lot of learning to do those key things that will actually change and redeem the world. Maybe by following and emulating the Rebbe, maybe by making sure that you put on your shoes in the same order as the Rebbe, and you wear the same hat as the Rebbe, and you sing the same niggun, the same tune to the davening as the Rebbe, maybe you're not just putting on your shoes and putting on a hat and singing a song. Maybe what you're really doing are those things that in fact are the essential ways to improve our world, to be significant, to make a difference. And the Kabbalistic viewpoint is very enabling in that way. And it says that when you're in a dark place, it just means that you have to look around for the spark that's hidden there. Right? God's presence is not in the study hall, and God's presence is not in the fancy shul, and God's presence is no more in the expensive house than the little hut on the edge of town. The darker it is, the more there's a chance to find that hidden spark and to bring light. So I think we can understand, again, none of these things are true or false. These are different perspectives. But we can understand not only in the early days of Hasidism, but I think today, why it is that so many people are drawn to this kind of an idea, to this kind of a philosophy, to this kind of a way of looking at the world. Right? In the last 200 years, there has been more physical progress, more scientific progress, more technological progress. There's been more food grown, more availability of healthcare, even in poor places in the world compared to what it used to be, everywhere. So how are we doing? So is all that stuff seem to be the secret? If it is, it sure ain't the whole secret, right? Because we don't seem to necessarily know so much more. Or, yeah, maybe we're healthier, maybe we live longer, but do we live more meaningfully? Do we live better than our ancestors? I think that's a really open question. And that's part of why this way of looking at the world, this way of thinking, is so important. And it's why I think that Hasidic stories are so powerful. Because they, in a nugget, and we'll look at a couple of strange ones a little bit later tonight, like I promised. But in a nugget, in a moment, they remind us in a way that's almost like a riddle, right? Why are they a riddle? Because truth that's obvious is not the truth. That's not the mystical way. Because real meaning, real truth, real significance in this world is at least semi-hidden. It's something we have to go and find and discover. Now, as I promised, I'm going to pause for a moment from Elie Wiesel, who I'll get to in a minute, and I'm going to explain all of Judaism to you in a couple of minutes. Okay, not really. That's one of my favorite things. I presented at a multi-faith conference. There were 7 different faiths available, and they gave each of the presenters a name tag. I still have my name tag, so I can, like, my mother can be proud. That's why I have it. And the name tag says, Rabbi Michael Dolgan, representing Judaism. So I don't think I did that very well, but I still got the name tag so I can show my mom. You know, there's only so much you can do. But I think it is important. I want to make these things we've just talked about as concrete as possible so that I leave you with more than just a headache. Okay? If you have a little bit of a headache, you know, a little suffering, it's okay. But not too much. Like I said, here's another book that if you haven't read it, I'm not going to read from it tonight, but this is what I'm going to share with you is based on the methodology of that book. It's a book that's actually a wonderful book, even though it doesn't sound like it to a Jewish perspective. It's called God is Not One. We've taught it here at Temple Sinai. How many people here have read God is Not One? Okay, very small number, so it's good to mention it to you. Okay, this is written by a religion professor from the Boston area, who the idea is not that he doesn't believe in monotheism. He's a religion professor. They're pretty much all atheists. But that happens to be true, by the way. What he's really saying by God is not one is he says in his book that there's this sort of patronizing idea that that people who don't like religion have, that all religions are just slightly different versions of exactly the same thing. And so when he says God is not one, he doesn't mean God. We can't say anything much about God. He's saying that it's nonsense to pretend that Judaism and Islam and Taoism and Hinduism and all the, you know, that they're all pretty much the same. They're just, you know, slightly different. It's not true. They're all fundamentally different ways of looking at the world, looking at ourselves, and about how it is that we live a meaningful, fulfilled, and significant life. They are different. And so what he does in his book is he uses the following methodology to define these traditions. He says each one of them is acknowledging a problem in the world, offering a solution to that problem, providing a technique or behavior to get from the problem to the solution, and offering an exemplar, right? Someone who is an example of success. All right? It's a really interesting way of conceiving of these different traditions. It doesn't mean that he's right either, but I think it's a really, really thoughtful book, and I think you'll like it if you take the time to read it. What I did was took that, and in one way I applied it to Judaism, but what I did subsequently that I'm handing out to you here is used his methodology to differentiate between Kabbalah in Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, Historical Judaism, and Reform Judaism. So that we can look quickly at how they're different, and then we'll move back on to Hasidic stories and Elie Wiesel. But I think it'll clarify some of what we were talking about Kabbalah. So if everybody can remain conscious, but somebody can help me pass out here, that would be really helpful. There should be enough for everybody, I think. Or if you're here with somebody, if you can share until we're sure they have enough, that would really be great. I didn't bring that with me, and I should. I sort of have in my head close to the name, but I don't know. There's only one book by that title. I'll try to bring you the title. You know, I'll bring you the title and the reference. No, it's not. No, it's definitely not. If I heard the name, I would know it. But I'm sorry, I can't think of it now. But that is the title of the book. God is not one. So how we doing? Who still doesn't have a handout? Good. Okay. Mazel tov. All right, there we go. Thank you. Stephen Prothero. You looked it up on your phone?
It's $1.99 Kobo star.
Stephen Prothero, Prothero, I believe. Stephen. It's really an excellent book. It's really thought-provoking. And for Judaism in general, let me just take you through what I have here so that we can get on to what it is we're also here about this week. When he says God is not one, here's kind of a general idea of defining Judaism, that the problem in our world is free will / fallibility, right? The problem is that we imperfect beings are able to actually make choices and do things, right? That we and our world are fallible and imperfect. The solution, there's kind of a pun here, is community. Right? Is coming together, right? God is one. That's the Jewish idea. So we're trying to create a sense of God's oneness by coming together despite our differences in this world. The technique for doing that is the covenant, is the relationship between God and the people of Israel, made up of mitzvot, made up of ritual ethical acts in which we might engage to improve ourselves and our world. And Judaism, I mean, it has subparts of Judaism have exemplars, but I would suggest that Judaism in general doesn't have an exemplar. In a way, it's you, in the sense that you don't tell every little Jewish boy to be Moses or every little Jewish girl to be Miriam. It's not really the way of our tradition, the same way other traditions have individuals who represent the whole tradition. We don't really have them. Everybody is fallible. And in a way, we're challenged to be an exemplar. But let's look at these subsets. And I just want to take the time, you know, looking at it through this particular methodology. So Kabbalah, what I would call it, again, when it's present in Hasidism as well, is really, as we said, God-centered Judaism. It's a Judaism that focuses on God and God's presence in the world. The problem is that God, though unified, is fractured in the physical world, is dispersed and hidden in sparks. The solution is to complete divine revelation by bringing God's unity into this world. Our job is to do tikkun olam, is to gather all the sparks and make this a world where God's presence is here and felt. The technique using secret divine formulas that enable us to free holy sparks through the mitzvot. Now, let me give you an example of that, because people say, you know, Dolgan, that's fine, but that's not really what Kabbalists do. You know, they're really kind of orthodox. And they just, you know, it's kind of orthodoxy with, you know, a little extra on the side. But that's really very much not the case. So, for example, when it says the using secret divine formulas. Okay, so this is my favorite sidur that none of you can have or find. I got it on a sidewalk sale in Mea Shearim at a publishing house that no longer exists. And it's a photographic copy of the personal sidur of Arya Leib Epstein, who was one of the rabbis who was a follower of the Ari of Simon Luria, who really created the Kabbalah that is at the basis of Hasidic Judaism. Okay? So this is his personal sidur, okay, handwritten, because, you know, who prints things? And this here is the Chatzi Kaddish. Okay? So right over here, I'm far enough away from you that I can confidently say that none of you can see, right? This says Yitgadal, right? Oh, where's the word Yitkadash? Oh, that's here, right? Yitgadal v'Yitkadash. Shemay, spelled differently than it's spelled in our prayer book. Rabba. Be'alma. Oh, sorry, it says Amen, because they say Amen there. And then Be'alma, and then it starts to use more words, right? So the first five words take up half a page. What are all of these? These are all codes that, from studying it, are everything from which aspect of the divine bridge between God and the world you should be thinking about. That's what people call the sefirot while you're doing this, as well as breathing exercises based on letters found in God's divine names. Okay? When we're saying Kabbalah and we're saying secret practices that in fact activate the world and divinity in it, that's what we're talking about. Okay? So it's not orthodoxy with a twist. It's really something different that says there are different ways to unify. We're not trying to unify the world. We're trying to unify God in the world. All right, so there's an example. And who is the exemplar? That's who Hasidic stories are about, is the tzaddik. Right? The tzaddik, again, doesn't in this case mean just a righteous person. What does it mean? It is the tzaddik who has a near divine ability to add sparks of spiritual life to the sleeping physical world. Okay? So we can learn from a Hasidic spiritual Kabbalistic perspective different things from these stories of tzaddikim, stories of great rabbis, because whether they ever did them or not, because they're about those rebbes, they have hidden within them the secrets to meaningful living. Okay? Now, to compare that, Orthodox Judaism is not God-centered Judaism. It is Judaism as unified practice. Right? Orthodox Judaism, actually more correctly, should have been called Orthoprax Judaism, because Orthodox means you believe the same thing. Orthodox Jews are like every other Jew. They don't all believe the same thing, but they do the same thing. That the goal is, within, not completely, but within a very wide range, unified, managed, proper religious action. That's the goal of Orthodox Judaism, not of Kabbalah. The problem is disagreement and disunification, or disobedience even, in Jewish life. The solution is centralized, written, and personal authority. To every question, there's a right answer. If you just look in the right place, that is a modern, because there didn't used to be such a thing, orthodox idea. What is the technique? Halakha is a written, codified legal system. Even the word halakha in the Talmud means totally different things than the word halakha, which means I'm not sure what to do. I got to ask somebody, and he will tell me what to do. Okay? One of my favorite quotes, it comes up 6 times in the Talmud, says, halakha ve'en osim ken. This is the halakha, we don't do it that way. Okay? Because the word halakha in the Talmud doesn't mean always do it this way. We can do a whole other class on what it does mean, but it's a modern idea to have orthopraxy, that every Jew should do the same thing. All right? And who is the exemplar? The posek, the great halachic decision maker of the generation. The other name, the gadol hador, the great of each generation. Eventually, we can work our way up to one person, effectively the supreme justice, the supreme rebbe of any generation, and we ask them, and whatever answer they give us, that's right. That's Orthodox Judaism. Now, historical Judaism, or community-centered Judaism, I'm going to suggest that leading up to modern times and whatever, that it was a little different. The problem is divided families, tribes, polity prevent a unified holy people, right? That the Jews, we're one people, we need to be together, we need to be unified, and the problem is we're not. Which is true, the solution, seeking a united people in all ages and places. This is about people being one community and having a shared responsibility and identity, not about exactly what they do. The technique, because Judaism is eventually a community-based religion, historically, that it's more about us than I, right? That it's holier to have a service with a minyan, say it's 6:30 before the class when you're coming at 7 anyway, than it is to pray spiritually by yourself. Because doing something with the community is a higher level. And that is a historically significant and very powerful Jewish value that says, you know, it's community, dummy. I mean, eventually that's what it's about, that we're about community. And the exemplar in this case is the Mashiach, who is a personal representation of that national purpose. The Mashiach, in that sense, historically, is not supernatural. We've been around the Christians for too long that we tend to think those things. That's not what Mashiach is. Mashiach, David, King David, was a Mashiach. Why? Because he was anointed king of Israel. So it means there's one political structure for our people, there's one king who represents the people and keeps the community together and supports the community, and that's the Mashiach. That's what a Mashiach is.
Isn't that what the word means, anointed?
Yes. But like any other word, it comes to mean what it doesn't etymologically mean. Right? So there are lots of different ideas, but in a sense of linguistics, Mashiach means anointed one. Anointed as in, you know, oil on the head. Okay? And Reform Judaism, just for fun, before we get back to our topic for the week, but I want to make this at least a little bit clear. So Reform Judaism, calling it this worldly Judaism. The problem is injustice and chaos in a God-connected world. The solution is tikkun olam, understood as concrete social action and person-centered synagogue life. Right? The idea is about making the actual world better and about personal meaning, right? That we're affirming personal meaning as a Jewish value. The technique, personal choice to act in support of community and society. It doesn't mean I can choose anything I want. That's not what it means. But it does mean that since it's hard to know in a real world that includes religion and science and lots of other ways to learn things, exactly what the right thing is going to be to do. So it's not that I get to choose. Reform Judaism is not a Chinese menu. I'd like 2 from column A and 1 from column B, and I'll see what I feel like next week. That's not what Reform Judaism is. Reform Jews choose because they have to, not because they get to. We choose because it's our goal to serve our people and higher purpose and to serve God. And we know as much as we can about what brings our people together, but we have to choose based on our own experience, our own knowledge, and our own connection to community about the best way for each of us as part of the community to serve God and make the world a better place. And that's what we do. And the exemplar, to be historical, are the prophets. That the original name for Reform Judaism was not Reform Judaism at all. It was Prophetic Judaism. Because when one reads the prophets, one reads about ritual Jews who knew that it wasn't just about ritual. Right? About people who lived a real life but spoke truth to power. About people who weren't popular but did what was right as they saw it and what they believed the Jewish future needed. Sometimes in a way that was very consistent with what came before, sometimes in a different way. And so that's really, if there is an exemplar from a reform perspective, we're less the priestly or the rabbinic Judaism as an exemplar than a prophetic Judaism. The sense that we have the obligation to speak that way, to act that way in a courageous and ethical manner. Okay, so these things are all just sort of to give us a different picture, and because I think it clarifies some things, but it really does say that Kabbalistic Judaism and Hasidic Judaism in its origin were enormously different from the other kinds of Judaism. And in fact, the more one's Hasidic Judaism is part of a Kabbalistic Hasidic spiritual world, the more it really is at a variance from any of these other worlds. It's probably as far from an Orthodox way of looking at the world as it is from a Reform way of looking at the world. Yes?
I just wanted to make a little comment.
Sure.
Prophetic Judaism, the prophet only spoke of what told him to say. So he was really, in a way, very connected to God. He found a creative way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
God is not prophetic.
Okay. What's being said is that the prophet spoke, you know, when God told the prophet to speak. And the prophet is very connected to God. Yeah. And again, I think Reform Judaism, it's one of places where Judaism is a little more traditional, like Toronto, we're a little less this way. But I think is a very religious expression of Judaism. Reform Judaism is. And I would say, just not accepting and welcoming those comments, that even the prophets in the Bible, only Moses always said what God actually was telling him. The rest of the prophets, it says very clearly in our tradition, heard God more through riddles and parables and didn't always get it right. There are specific prophecies of Isaiah in the Bible that turn out to be wrong. He clearly says one thing's going to happen and another thing happens. Doesn't mean Isaiah wasn't a prophet. It means that being a prophet is listening for God and trying to speak the divine truth in the world with the acknowledgement that unless shockingly you're actually Moses, you're not going to get it right every time. And so I do think that we are carrying, that the idea of a lot of Reform Judaism is to carry that on. I think a lot of Reform Judaisms, I don't know, like mine personally, and Toronto Reform Judaism is much more communally oriented than this prophetic model. But when people wonder sometimes how come some areas of Reform practice seem so radical and so different, which we are sometimes, I think it's because of this part of what Reform Judaism is about, which probably is strongest in United States Reform Judaism, even than other places, but I think it's part of what we are. But I really do appreciate the comment. And now back to our regularly scheduled Hasidic stories. So I have for you tonight two stories that I want to share with you, because I wanted to make sure that we had some time studying some really strange stuff. But again, Hasidic stories are about looking for what's hidden. And there are two stories here that I want to share with you, both of which I just think are really interesting. And one, the example on the front page, which is the title for the class, we're going to read first. And I think that one is a really, really sort of represents a lot of Hasidic stories. And I love the one on the back because it's just so out there. So if I can again have somebody help me distribute these. And wait. I'm going to ask you to do what I asked you to do last week. If you weren't here, please choose a partner or two. Read the story together. And what you're looking for are, what are your questions? We'll get to the answers. But what are your questions that you have that this raises with you? Okay? And so we'll do that, and then we'll gather our questions, talk about a little bit, move on to the other story, and then conclude with Wiesel's autobiographical take on some of these stories. So here's story number one for tonight. A villager and his wife came to see the Rebbe of Mezrich and asked of him that he pray that they be given a child. The Magid, which is the name of the Rebbe of Mezrich, was a Magid. A Magid is someone who tells stories and wisdom. The Magid asked that they give him 52 gold pieces, the number of the word Ben. The computer turned those letters around. Son. Nun stands for 50 in Gematria, and Bet is 2. So a son, 52 gold pieces, and then he would promise this to them. The villager was shocked to hear this great amount and said to him that he would give him 10 gold pieces. Quite a sum itself. However, the Magid of Mezrich would not agree. The villager thought he could settle the matter in a good way, and that the Magid would not sense it, for the villager thought that the Rebbe was not wise in matters of money. He went to the market and exchanged 20 gold pieces for many copper coins, and again entered the room of the Rebbe. He spread the coins upon the table and said to him, "Look how much money I'm giving." The Magid responded that there are not 52 gold pieces here, and I will not come down from the price. The villager turned to his wife in anger and said to her, "Take the money off the table. The blessed Eternal One will help us without the Magid." Immediately the Magid was overcome with joy and said, "This is what I've been waiting to see." The words of the villager were heard in the heavens, and the villager and his wife were given a son. Okay, questions? Yes, Marcia. Okay, if he believed that the Magid had all this power to give him a son, why would he sort of try this workaround? That's a great question. Give me another question. Yes.
Why did the Magid say, "This is what I have been waiting to see," rather than to hear? Because then he said the words of the villager were heard in the heavens.
Okay, that's a really great question. There are a number of really interesting verbs here. Right, I tried to translate them as directly as I could. Right, this is, you've been waiting to see, not waiting to hear. Notice that earlier on is a similar question. If nobody came up with it, but maybe you did. That when he changed all the coins and stuff, it says that earlier on the villager thought he would settle the matter in a good way, and the Magid would not sense it. Not that he wouldn't see it, not that he wouldn't know it, that he wouldn't sense it, right? So a number of them, the verbs are not the verbs we would expect if it was a straightforward story. Absolutely. Good question. Yes? Why is he asking him to pay for the son anyway, right? They didn't have shoulders in Mezrich. What's he paying for? Yes, in the back.
What is the value of this belief system?
I'm not sure what you mean. Say more.
Mm-hmm. Much greater value than any sort of number, except the gentleman or the man and woman asking the question didn't fully appreciate it, but they actually did. It came out saying, "The Eternal One will take care of us," which was the Magid's.
Okay, so the question is, what is the story trying to tell us about what really has value?
Right.
Let me take that from the two of those. Yes. Is that right? What is it trying to tell us about where value really is? So thank you. That's great. Yes. Yeah, the villager asked for a child, and they gave him
a son.
A son. Okay? And actually the word that's used in the version of the story that I have, the beginning one is Vlad, is much more generic. It doesn't say son or daughter, but then it is the son. Right? So that is interesting. And what's with that? Yes.
Well, was the original story 52, though?
Yeah.
So there was an implication of a bet.
Oh, yeah. No. That's from the story. He said, he didn't say 52 gold pieces because he, you know, saw they were nice clothes or something. The guy's just a regular villager anyway. It's because, and why is it because? That's an important question that I'll deal with. Why does he take it from the word son? Right, maybe because the word daughter costs 402. Right, because bat is 402. It could be a value of males versus females, but it's also true that the gematria of daughter is 402. And the gematria of son is 52. Right? So, is it patriarchal or is it about the letters? No, that's a good question. It's not an obvious answer to that question. Is it patriarchal or is it about the letters? And, yes, Jeff.
There's a couple of messages in here. One is...
I'm looking for questions now, though.
Well, it's a question.
The question is, do you agree, Rabbi? Yes.
One of the meanings of this...
Yes.
Go through a mediary and deal directly with God.
Okay.
And it is another meaning. You can't buy favor with God. You have to...
Okay, so that goes back to the value idea, right? Can't buy me love, right? Can you buy what you really want? And it is a story about being taught through an intermediary that you can't go through an intermediary. Right? So it is interesting that way, that on the one hand, it's about going direct, but he only was put in a position to go direct by going to an intermediary in the first place. Larry was waiting.
Yeah, why would the Magid be overjoyed when he's given certain advice when he's asked, and then he gets overjoyed when the advice is rejected?
Right, why is he overjoyed when his advice is rejected? I know that nothing makes me happier than when I ask somebody for a donation for the shul and they tell me no. I just do a little dance. Oh, no, that's not what happens. Anyway, but no, it's a good question, right? That he's thrilled when the guy finally says, you're nuts.
No, he didn't say that. He didn't say you're nuts.
He didn't say you're nuts, but he's angry. And he says, I'm not paying. I'm not doing what you said. Well, absolutely. But the Magid, again, right? It's fakert, right? You can't just tell him, just pray to God. That's not Hasidic. Right? The way to learn what's true is the long way is the short way. Right? You got to go the long way around because only then are you going to come to it. If he went to the Magid and the Magid said, oh, you don't need me, just pray sincerely to Hashem and God will give you a son, you're all good. Never would have happened. Right? Because that's not how, because the world doesn't work in a simple, straightforward, direct way. And that wisdom is not, in this story, wisdom's not in the Magid. It's in the Magid knowing how to help his chassid find it in himself.
Right?
Yes?
What is the gematria for 20 gold pieces? Has he exchanged 20?
I don't think there's any gematria intended there.
But why is it listed? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think, again, why 10 and why 20? Because he has to get the chassid to a point. You look at that guy's behavior, it's standard economic business behavior. I can give you no more than 10. Okay, 20. Right? I mean, that's what we do. If we're buying a car, if we're doing whatever, this is the behavior. Right? This is what you do. So he's got to, the Rebbe has to get the villager, the kfari, the villager, out of this worldly thinking. This worldly thinking is not going to get him otherworldly help. So this worldly thinking is, I go to the holy man and he does it for me. And then when he gets a price, he thinks that he can just, he's being told that he can buy what he wants. And yeah, no, it's okay. Go ahead. I'll continue. And
it's so hard that it's a villager and not an ordinary simple Jew. Mm-hmm. They were treated as villagers, not as simply Jews.
Yeah, I mean, he's being, right, it's calling somebody a villager is almost, I mean, it doesn't say Amma Aretz, but that's kind of the idea. Is you're sort of, you know, you're the simple people, you don't really know. But the simple people is where the real wisdom is in Hasidic thinking. And again, now, why does it say, why 52? I think a couple of different reasons. On the, right, 402, out of the question. Okay, so, you know, that could be. Now, why do they want to use the numbers? One reason is that the Rebbe wants to appear like he's giving a price for some reason. Right? You're buying a son. Son Beit Nun is 52. So give me 52, you get a son. Looks like an exchange, except why does he choose 52? Because there's no way a simple Jew has 52 gold pieces. Right? He's giving him an impossible price. Right? Because you can't buy what you want. So, but he knows that telling him you can't buy what you want is not going to teach him anything. So instead, he starts, you have to start where people are. So he starts with the assumption that you can buy your way. Right? And he tells him a crazy number. But I will say that the Kabbalistic world is made up more of letters than of rocks and trees. Okay? That a Kabbalistic way of thinking, which colors much of Hasidism, is that the world, remember, we're not going from a concrete beginning to a concrete ending. We're going from a divine creation that's not finished to a world full of the divine. And God's names are made of letters. Okay? The world is made of letters from a Kabbalistic perspective, because the real reality is the hidden, mystical, Hebrew letter, scroll-related reality, not all that stuff you think you see. So it's also possible that the real problem is not the 52, is that he thinks the amount is 52. No, it's a bet and a nun. That the world is made of letters, because that is a Kabbalistic way of looking at the world. But the Kfari, he can't hear that. And so why is he overjoyed? Because the Magid knows that in his world, the reason they don't have a child, and I don't mean to offend anybody, I know about modern issues of infertility, please don't read any of those modern things. No, I have to say it, because people, it's very tender for people, and I don't want anybody to leave here thinking I said what I didn't say. Okay? It's not about that. But in this spiritualized way of looking at the universe, the reason they don't have a child is because they're not praying sincerely for one. Is because they're not enough in touch with the spark within them to create the reality that they want. And so he's rejoiced, because only when the guy says, take the money off the table, God will do it, does he finally know how this all works. Right? But he had to take him through all the steps in order to get there, because learning doesn't come from a smart guy telling us what's true. Learning comes from discovering the spark within that actually knows the divine truth, but that we are in our own way all the time and don't know how to find that. Yes, Marie.
Is it mischievous? Doesn't this teach
what's the wrong lesson that it teaches?
Villager is trying to pull a fast one on the Magid.
Mm-hmm.
And he's being rewarded for pulling this fast one.
I don't think he's trying, you know, I think that the question is, you know, isn't he being rewarded for bad behavior, right? He sort of tries to pull a fast one with all the copper coins and everything else. I think, though, again, I think Hasidic stories understand people's pain, right? So he didn't do that because he's a bad, dishonest guy. He did that, they did that, because they're in pain. And they're desperate. And they have nowhere to turn because they want a child and they can't have one. And so he does what he knows to do. He's trying to do anything. So I think that, again, there is a Jewish rule. Let's look at it this way too. And then I'm going to move on to the other story because we're going to run a little over, but I want to get everything in tonight. There's a Jewish rule that says that the Baal Tshuva, the person who does tshuva, who does a wrong thing and realizes it, is at a higher spiritual level than a person who never sinned in the first place. We're a little used to that, but think about that from a religious perspective. That's radical. Okay? It says you're holier if you sin and genuinely get beyond it than if you don't sin. Okay? So look at it through that lens. This is a guy who sinned and then actually discovered out of that sin, this higher place of how the world really works. We don't have to like it. If you don't like that story, you'll hate the one on the other side. So how many of you read the one on the other side already anyway? Just a couple, not most. All right, I'm sorry to stop, but I want to get done at least by 8:45. So turn over and read this other story. At the time when they came to take Rabbi Yisroel of Rushton to prison, he paused and told this story. There once was a great king who had no children. In his older years, he was blessed with one good, beautiful daughter. The daughter was so precious in the eyes of the king and the queen that when she grew up and came of age, they wanted to find her a perfect shidduch, a perfect partner. So they chose for her a groom who was precious and spiritual. After the daughter's wedding, she became pregnant. The king, and at least it was after the wedding, the king and queen were unsure what they would do when the time of birth came and the pains of birth took hold of their daughter. How would they stand to hear their dear daughter cry out? The king said to the queen, "Certainly our intelligent daughter, Maskelet, that's the Hebrew word there for intelligent. It's backwards, though. The intelligent daughter, certainly our intelligent daughter will take pity on us and not cause us distress, and will know in her wisdom to stop herself from crying out, even if it pains her. No problem." And so it was that their intelligent daughter strengthened herself with all her might so she would not cry out in distress and sadden the heart of her mother and father. Finally, at the moment of the birth of the child, the birth pains grew so strong upon her that a troubled cry of "Oi!" escaped her. Her mother and father were greatly disturbed and took a great branch and struck her on the head, since she was not able to stop herself for this one additional small moment. The end. Yes, Shelley. Okay, and the question is, it was asked before, why is the Rebbe going to prison? We don't know. The most common reason, I explained, it's not because he's a criminal. Okay, the most common reason rabbis went to prison was because the local non-Jewish ruler needed money. And so they would throw the community leader in prison and make the community ransom them, make them buy them back, in order to get them out. So that is the most common reason why a rabbi, like many rabbis, Rabbi Meir of Rothberg famously wouldn't let them ransom him, all these sort of things. That's the most, we don't know, but that's the most likely reason that he was headed off to prison. Yes? So
the follow-up for that is why did he tell his story?
Okay, so if he's about to head off to prison, why did he tell the story? Okay? That obviously, that we know that Hasidic stories are not about irrelevant details. right? There's no way this story is supposed to be told without the introduction. Doesn't mean you couldn't also use it without, because I know you're all dying to tell the story to everyone you know, but it's clearly connected to the beginning. Okay, what else? Other questions? Len?
What is the significance of the fact that he never had children but only his older years? What is the significance of having children?
Okay, what's the significance of the whole older years thing? Good question. Larry and then Bev?
Well, the obvious question is, why are the king and queen so full of themselves? And not worried about the daughter and her pain and childbirth, but about their ears.
Okay. So the king and queen are so connected. They're so in love with their daughter that hearing her in pain is going to be so painful for them that they can't take it. So she shouldn't do it. Okay? No, it's a very difficult story that way. Bev, I said you were next.
Well, in both of these stories and the longing for a child in the older age is going back to Abraham and Sarah.
Okay, so we do know that sort of older age child, the ultimate example is Abraham and Sarah, right? They wait and they wait and they wait, and they finally have a child. But it's a recurring theme in biblical stories of difficulty having children. Absolutely. I saw it. Yeah. Okay. That's right. Can we please get 52 gold pieces and buy the king and queen some noise-canceling headphones? Absolutely. Okay, yes. And then Sally, yes.
Why is it that the reaction to her pain, and her pain distressing them, is to cause her even more pain?
Isn't that the best part of the story? That's where you go, I can't believe Dolgan made me read this story. Right? It's when they hit her on the head with a stick.
A large stick.
It's why I called it a branch, because a stick doesn't do justice. Right? It's an eighth. I mean, it's a big hunk of tree that they hit her in the head with.
Why,
Sally.
Why does the king and queen think that their daughter needs a perfect match, and it seems like they have perfect expectations of their daughter?
Okay. Why, what's with that they want perfection, right? They want things to be perfect. They want the husband to be perfect. They want the birth to be perfect, right? So that is a really good question. What's with the, right? They lose their minds and hit her in the head with a stick because they wanted this to be perfect. And yeah, that everybody's had a perfect birth, right, of a child. Exactly. I saw a hand way back here, and then Faith. Yeah. Okay. Why are they focused on the birth and not on the child? Right. Why are they focused on that and not what comes after? Great question. I already said Faith. Yeah, and then we're going to talk about it.
Why does the daughter become the guilty party in this as opposed to the parents?
Yeah. No, why? Well, I don't know. She's certainly the suffering party. I don't know that she's guilty. No, this is important. I don't know that she's guilty, but she's suffering. Okay? So two really quick, and then we want to... Yes?
What does intelligence have to do with reactions to pain?
Okay. And I think that's why they chose the term here. What does it matter if she's intelligent? Right? But that's their expectation, right? Is that she's smart enough not to react to pain. Which is... It doesn't make any sense. Yes, last comment. Then I got to talk... She says, you can go, Dory.
Okay, so the daughter was so precious in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
The eyes are very, okay, they say the eyes. So
right.
Their eyes had to see something perfect. mm-hmm. but their ears couldn't hear anything that wasn't perfect.
Okay.
Because they're saying the eyes and hearing.
Okay, they're focused more on what they see, on appearances,
right.
and they can't hear.
Right.
Right? They're unwilling to hear the reality of what it is that's going on. Right? They want to see a perfect world. Now, first of all, I'm not going to all of a sudden make this all nice. Okay? So if you're waiting for me to make this all nice, I'm not going to make it all nice. However, what I will tell you is what this is what they call a mushel. This is a parable. Okay? So it's not a story in the sense of the other things we've been looking at are Maaseh Tzedikim. Here's something a great righteous rabbi did. That's one kind of Hasidic story. This is a different kind of Hasidic story. This is a parable. Most of them start with a king or a king and a queen. Right? And they tell a story where the characters in the story represent other things. Okay? It's a very common kind of Hasidic story. So the purpose of this is not to say that they hit some, that they had a daughter and she was having a baby and they hit her in the head with a branch. Okay? That's not to tell that story. It's a story about something else. It's a story about perfection and lack of perfection. It's a story about the basic element of most people's lives, which was suffering. Right? And there is a particular significance to this kind of suffering. Okay? Birth pangs are what are called in Jewish mystical parlance, when they are called Chevle Mashiach, literally means the birth pangs of the Messiah. The idea that suffering in this world, just like suffering in childbirth, is unavoidable. There is no way to get to the goal, to get to Mashiach without suffering. It can't be done. And in fact, suffering has a value. There's a term called Yisurin Shel Ahava, which literally means afflictions of love. That's a nickname for suffering that people go through. That it's part of God's love that these people are suffering. They're afflicted because we want to get to a better world, and we can't get there without suffering. It can't be done. And it's not holy people's suffering. It's suffering. It's people's individual suffering. And if we only focus on the suffering, we're not supposed to like what they do. Of course it's foolish to hit her in the head. Right? Why do they hit her in the head?
She should suffer too.
Because they can't take the suffering that's necessary. The Rebbe's going to prison. How's it going to be for him? Right? He ain't going to the Don jail, and I wouldn't want to go there. Okay? Prison is a place where people die. I think dungeon is a better word. Right? This is a place of travail and suffering. Okay? And why did we say they tend to throw the Rebbe in prison? For ransom. And why do they pay the ransom? Because they can't stand the idea that the Holy Rebbe is languishing in the prison cell. Okay? And so why do they pay ransom to these non-Jews, which is forbidden in Jewish law because it encourages the behavior? Right? When you pay, it keeps happening. So he's saying, if you ransom me, you are as foolish as these people who hit their pregnant daughter in the head because they couldn't hear her suffering. Of course I'm suffering, but I'm bringing Mashiach. I'm suffering because it's our lot to suffer. And don't give in and say you can't. You don't have to like the idea. I love the facial expressions I'm getting. It's like I'm hitting you in the head with a stick. And I'm not. These are not ideas that we have to like. But they are fascinating ideas and important ideas, whether we agree with them or not. And the idea of what he's saying is he's saying to them, I'm going to suffer. You're going to hate it. Don't give in to it. Don't pay too much. Don't encourage this behavior. Don't be foolish and do what they want you to do. Right? And that really, I think, is the meaning of this story and why he tells it when he's going to prison. Because anybody who reads the end of that story says, that is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard in my entire life. And he's trying to make sure that his chassidim, when they go to do what they think is their holy job of coming up with huge amounts of money to ransom the Rebbe, he wants them to say to themselves, this is the foolish, most foolish thing we have ever done. Right? But it's a Hasidic way to get the message. He doesn't say, don't ransom me. He doesn't say, find a nice price. You know, enough to get me out, but not too much. He says, don't focus on the suffering. Focus on the end game. Whether the end game is bringing the Mashiach or looking after the community, because we don't want people to keep getting thrown in prison, he's telling them, don't just focus on the suffering. You got to look beyond it to what's next. Okay? Yes?
How does that relate to hitting the daughter in the head?
How does it relate to hitting the daughter on the head? In these stories, and it doesn't work as well here, it takes a lot of work, but that's okay. In these stories generally, the king is God, and the daughter is the people of Israel, is Yidden, right, is the Jews. That's the most common approach to this story, right? And again, he doesn't want them to think they're doing some mitzvah of ransoming him, and what they're really doing is they're striking a blow against the Jewish people. By refusing to accept that this world includes suffering, and trying to live in a world where the Rebbe never has to suffer and nothing has to happen, what are they doing? They're actually hurting the Jewish people when it seems like they're doing otherwise. I think that's, you know, that's the way I understand that part of the story. But again, parables. I'll tell you a parable next time about parables. Okay, that's how I'll start next time, is with a parable about parables. But listen carefully. I want to conclude with what I said I would end with. I know we're a little late, but we only have 3 sessions. There's a lot to do. So thank you for sticking with me. One of the chapters in the book is about Moshe Leib of Sasov, who was one, again, a great Hasidic Rebbe. He tells of him, about Sasov, where Sasov is, but listen, he's talking about Sasov in the 1700s, but listen to the way he tells it. Sasov is in the Ukraine, not far from Lvov. The first Jews settled there in the 16th century. In 1726, they obtained special privileges from Jacob Sobieski, son of King Sigismund III of Poland. Their communal and religious institutions were all declared tax exempt. In 1939, the community numbered 1,500 souls. All perished in Belzec and Zlochev. Today, Sasov looks like all Jewish small towns used to look, only there are no more Jews, except for Rebbe Moshe Leib, whose memory remains linked to Sasov. Who was he? Here I must confess, my attitude toward him has undergone several radical changes. When I first discovered him, I was happy to have found a Rebbe who was happy. I mean, really happy, totally happy with his lot. In him, I said to myself, I had found at last one great master who was not involved in messianic conspiracies like the seer of Lublin, who did not repress anguish like the Rebbe of Berdichev, who was not engaged in endless battles against despair, one who had not succumbed to melancholy like the Rebbe of Kotsk. Rabbi Moshe Leib seemed to me full of true joy. His joy was neither subterfuge nor pretext nor vehicle. It was an end in itself, and I was grateful. Later, I became annoyed. The very serenity that had appealed to me earlier began to disturb me. How could he? I wondered. How could he, the master and founder of his followers, be happy when they were not? Could he have been blind to their woes? Could he have been that insensitive, that self-centered? Then came the third stage. As I went over the texts and testimonies again and again, I recognized my error. Rabbi Moshe Leib, who seemed so carefree and at peace with himself, was neither. And I began to love him. He liked him, then he was annoyed with him, then he loved him. Of course, he lived a couple hundred years ago. Why? Because he was actually happy, which, as you read in the book, when you read it, almost none of the Hasidic masters were. Right? But then how can one be happy in a world of so much suffering, especially among the followers? Oh. He's not really happy. He seems happy. He's willing to put on a happy face even as he experiences the suffering. There's no change in the Rebbe of Sasov. He's been dead for 2 centuries. But he's not. He's alive for Wiesel. And I think as you're here, he is Wiesel. Right? Wiesel, the way he tells these stories, it's not just the stories. You can read Hasidic stories in lots of places. Reading Elie Wiesel telling them is because he's telling you about himself. Right? I don't think this is a story about a Rebbe. I think this is a story about a survivor. It's a story about a survivor who survived when so many didn't. Right? Who ended up trotting around the globe making speeches while still so many people in the world suffered. A person who had to come to terms at different stages of his life with the unspeakable suffering that he lived, and then the equally uncharacteristic life that he lived afterward when so many were already gone. And what he's doing is trying to figure out how he's going to live with the reality of his life. What helps him? These stories help him. And it's by sharing his struggles and triumphs and challenges with the stories that he tells us what these stories are really for. They're an opportunity for us likewise, and Wiesel's story, which is eventually a Hasidic story, is to help us look inside ourselves, is to give us a chance to see where we're at, to know that, like I started with the story, right, that God is the same, but we're not. So every time we hear the story, every time we tell the story, we're a different person with a different lesson to learn, a different path to follow, to find the holiness in us, to find the gift that we, in a smaller but equally meaningful way as Wiesel, have to give to the world. Certainly, if he could do it with what he lived through, it's not too much to ask of us.